Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Michael Wald, and thank you so much for tuning in to Ask the Blood Detective. This is Dr. Michael Wald. I am the director of longevity and nutrition at a natural health center in Mount Kisco, New York. It's about an hour or so north of New York City. And on Ask the Blood Detective, as my regular listeners know, this is a show where you get to ask your questions, where you get to develop your strengths and education so that you can become your own blood detective. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, that you necessarily don't seek out someone to help you make proper healthcare choices, but you have a clue, you're educated, you can make better choices, you are well informed. Now, today's show, I am super excited about it. I don't know if you can hear it in the tone of my voice, but so many of you are always asking me through the blog, or especially through emails and calls, Dr. Wald, you say, what is the best diet? I hear about this alkaline diet. What about the Mediterranean diet? What about an anti-inflammatory diet? What about a hormone diet? What about a ketogenic diet? What about a high-protein diet or a blood type diet? Which is the best one? I'm so confused. So you should be confused, because there is so much misinformation out there about dieting, or what I like to call, you know, a plan for life, how we should be eating, a healthy lifestyle. You know, if we use the terminology of diet, at least to me, it sounds restrictive. And there certainly are times during the course of our health that we might need more or less restrictive ways of eating to, let's say, manage diarrhea or maybe constipation or gas or bloating or food allergens. So, of course, there are going to be times when we need to have very, very precise, even neurotic sort of attention paid to our diets. But oftentimes, this is a lot easier than you might think. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to give you a bit of a taste, no pun intended, of the different types of dietary and food plans. I'm going to let you know my thoughts, because this is what you're asking for in your communications to me, of what my thoughts and applications are for these different food plans. Now, just as a reminder, you can reach me, for those of you who would like to work with me at any point, by calling my office, Integrated Nutrition, at 914-242-8844. And any questions or comments that you have on today's show or about any of the other past shows that are up in the archives, or that you can find on my website at www.integratednutrition.com. NY.com under the blog section, just shoot me an email. The best email is info@blooddetective.com. I'd like to start off by talking about some general concepts about diet and eating. And I've said this on prior shows, but you know, we've all heard that old adage, you are what you eat. And if that were true, then maybe a specific diet, we could count on the content of that diet being absorbed in our bodies. Except the truth of the matter is, and you'll know this once I say it, your holistic common sense will simply tell you, is that we are not what we eat. We are what we absorb from what we eat. And the average 50-year-old has some degree of malabsorption, which is a fancy term for we are not what we eat. So some of us maldigest or malabsorb maybe 5% of what we intake, or maybe it's 10%, and others it's 50%. We can't know unless we take a very careful health history and do appropriate lab testing for the different types of malabsorption conditions. You know, the symptoms of malabsorption can look like anything, because everything may be related to our diets, or at least have some major influence, or our diets may impact our health in different ways. So my other shows, that particularly the one called Everything Digestive, is something you should listen to. That's a primer on digestion and absorption. And then I have a show on all the different types, or many, I should say, not every one, but most of the more popular types of malabsorptive syndromes that even most gastroenterologists do not check. But fundamentally, we all want to eat in a way that supports us enjoying our lives to the fullest. So therefore, we want to either maintain our health or use diet and lifestyle to reach health. And then there are those, and I place myself, and of course many of you in this category, where you want to optimize your health and well-being. You know, this coming February 9th, I will be 51 years old. I have no physical limitations. I run marathons fast. I lift weights. I can do anything that I need to in life. I can walk all day long. I can run up hills. I can do what I need to do. And my basic lifestyle and my dietary choices have made a major impact upon this. And we have more than enough nutrition and scientific studies that show the potential benefits of eating specific ways. Now, as a fundamental approach to how we eat, most of us that are listening, at least to this show, know that a diet that is heavy in refined and processed sugars is a bad thing, promoting inflammation, promoting immune issues, affecting our body's pH or acid-base balance in adverse ways, which can lead to chronic inflammation, oxidative stress, hormonal imbalances, in other words, aging badly. So of course, whatever food plan or healthy lifestyle plan we choose to follow, I do believe it should have some things in common. Number one is not eating, whenever possible, refined and processed sugars and carbohydrates. The average American, last statistics I read, consumes approximately 175 pounds of sugar annually. That's incredible. And since I'm not consuming any of it, someone's eating a whole lot more than that. That's one thing. Fried foods, obviously bad. Saturated fats or fried foods, they increase cardiovascular disease. They increase the viscosity or thickness of blood, adversely affecting circulation. If we don't circulate well, we can't get oxygen, idealized oxygen concentrations to our tissues, an oxygen exchange of carbohydrate and oxygen. We may not have normal nutritional delivery to tissues with a sluggish, viscous blood supply. We may not detoxify appropriately. Toxins may accumulate. Things that are sluggish and thicker just don't move, and saturated fats add to that. Not to mention, there isn't a chronic degenerative disease on some level, including but certainly not limited to all sorts of cardiovascular disease, heart attacks, stroke, cancer, diabetes, that is not related to a higher than high intake or just an average intake of too much saturated fats and, of course, sugars. As a general rule, my personal belief is we want to eat lower down on the food chain. And what this simply means is that if we consume more plant-based diets, they tend to be lower in concentration of toxins. So, for example, if those plants are eaten by cows and we derive meat from cows and we eat the meat, there is what is known as bioaccumulation of toxins. So, in general, possibly, and I absolutely believe, that a more vegetable base diet is certainly ideal. Now, having said that, and I'll be getting into this in quite a bit of detail in just a few moments, there may be reasons that a high vegetable-based diet for the short term may not be appropriate. Let's say if someone's having an acute episodes of diverticulitis, which is a condition where the diverticuli or the pockets in the colon or the large intestine are irritated, and the high-fiber foods can actually aggravate it. So the point I'm trying to make with that one example is that there always are exceptions to every diet approach to health and well-being. Also, the foods that we eat may interfere with how certain medications work, or even supplements if we choose to take them. So some wherewithal or knowledge about drug-food interactions, both positive interactions and negative interactions, should be discussed. So, for example, the most common fruit that affects the largest number of medicines by reducing their effects. Again, if you're going to take medicine, I'm assuming you want them to work. But if you have a diet high in grapefruits, there is a chemical in grapefruits called naringenin. And naringenin will affect the metabolism in the liver of many different drugs. So that's, again, just one example. So it's very important that any nutritional person you see has knowledge in drug food and drug nutritional supplement interactions. Once again, both positive and negative ones. So another goal, you know, I started speaking about goals of an ideal diet, whatever that is, which is the topic of today's show. You know, what is the perfect diet? Is we might have weight loss goals. Some of us may have weight gain goals. So, for example, if someone has any form of cancer, studies have shown that those who have cancer that happen to get chemotherapy, by and large, will tend to survive better if they are overweight. Sounds a bit conflicting there, doesn't it? A bit counterintuitive, but if you think of it this way, that fat on the body acts as a reservoir to store toxins like chemotherapy toxins plus others that are fat soluble and store up in the fat tissue. The body does that innately because it dilutes the effects of the toxins. So again, the point I'm trying to make here is that we need a certain amount of fat on the body. We want a certain ratio of fat to lean body mass. And also that ratio of lean body mass to fat mass to water weight percentage can be measured with a test that's one of my favorites, which I've mentioned on almost every show, is a body composition. So whatever food plan you think is best for you, my opinion is if it does not favorably change your percentage of muscle, water, and fat to one another in specific ways, then it's not adding to longevity. You know, when people try new diets, they draw conclusions very quickly about whether or not they work or not. They might have a feeling of great improvement in sense of wellness after, let's say, a day or two, and they might conclude that must be from the diet. Maybe. But any food plan that you start, particularly under supervision of someone who knows what, if you're being managed for a health problem and knows what they're doing, would say to you, as I will, that you would want to give it a certain number of weeks to really see how your body actually adjusts, because the mind does direct itself towards health and healing as well. And over time, though, if there's not an actual physiological effect of that diet, that greater sense of well-being that might have been sort of hope, wishful thinking might fade, or it might not. And then you can have your answer whether or not the diet is really good for you. But I wouldn't just rely on how you feel. You know, I had a few patients this week that were very confused about the fact that they felt well. They came to me for a wellness workup, but I found some significant health problems in these particular two individuals. They said, well, how come I don't have symptoms? Well, I said, you know, you may have symptoms tomorrow. You may have symptoms in a week, a month, or 5 or 10 years from now. Symptoms happen when they happen. And long before symptoms happen, there are usually derangements in the chemistry. Something goes wrong. So the other point here I'm trying to emphasize is that I do not believe there's an ideal diet. There is a fundamental base from where you come from, and then you personalize it. So we just spoke before, low intake to no intake of refined and processed carbohydrates and white flours and saturated fats and trans fats. We want to eat lower down on the food chain. Of course, we want to emphasize foods of different types that are higher in certain nutrients that we need based on our symptoms, our health goals, medications, genetics, that sort of thing. So let me digress to a question that just came through my email about this topic, and the person is asking, do I have to follow an exact strict diet all the time? You know, what do I eat? How do I eat it? When do I eat it? How much do I eat? Now, that's a loaded question. So I'm going to answer that. So to answer the question or part of the question, do I always have to follow a diet? Well, there are certain fundamentals that each of us may need to follow if we want to enjoy a certain level of health and freedom and symptom-free living and, you know, a greater sense of well-being. And like exercise, if you stopped exercising, you wouldn't expect that your fitness would be maintained. So when people say to me, Dr. Wald, how long do I have to eat this way? And I give them that analogy. As long as it makes you feel good, your blood work is good, your chemistry is good, and your body composition is good. Why do I keep bringing up this body composition concept throughout my shows? Let me emphasize something to each and every one of you out there. No matter what your health endeavors, no matter what you're doing to improve your health and well-being, if you want to know if you are statistically improving your chances of offsetting future risk of most major killers that kill us prematurely and steal our quality of life away, we have determined in scientific circles that the better you maintain a body composition, that is what it means. If you have a greater amount of retention and improvement or gain of what's known as lean body mass, it's also called free fat mass, meaning it's free of fat. So the more lean organ mass you have, the better. So as we get older, we atrophy, we shrink, we have more fat on us, generally speaking, we have less lean organ mass. It's the organ mass which controls everything. So whatever your diet is, whatever nutrients you're taking, you want to have some repeat and comparative body compositions. I also believe, as a blood detective, you'd want to measure your blood pH from time to time and often enough so you can see what your variation of blood pH is. Blood pH for a healthy person should generally be, on average, 7.4. Now, for those of you that are confused by that and know something about pH or what's known as acid-base balance, you might be thinking of saliva and urine. Those are not longevity measurements. Saliva and urine pH change every few minutes, every few hours, days. They're important for certain aspects of health. For example, if your urine pH is too alkaline, remember, alkaline is supposed to be a good thing. It's not a good thing in the urine. You want to be on the acid end of the pH scale. That's why acidophilus helps urinary tract infections, because it helps to lower the urinary pH, which means more towards the acid side. So the point in this whole pH conversation and body composition is that these are fundamental tools, along with other things that I use, dietary logs, more detailed laboratory tests of absorption or malabsorption, nutrient levels, tests of nutrient use. You know, it's one thing to absorb something. It's one thing to get a level, quote unquote, normal, but is it optimal for you? I do not believe that in this toxic world of emotional toxicity, electromagnetic toxicity, biochemical toxicity, that even the best diet alone will not be able to meet needs. This argument about whether food is more important than supplements, I don't understand it. Why can't both have their place? So, yes, particularly for those over 40 years old, I always recommend some type of nutritional supplementation on top of a diet. So back to the question, do I always have to follow a certain diet? Yes, you always have to follow whatever changing nutritional needs and dietary or lifestyle, healthy lifestyle choices in terms of foods you need to maintain whatever level of health you have and or if you want to get somewhere else. And the other part of that question that I was asked, which I like this question, is also, you know, what do I eat? How often? When do I eat? Well, again, another general concept of eating healthy is eating often. You've heard this before, probably elsewhere, but it's true. Animals in the wild, mammals, for example, tend to eat pretty much constantly whenever they can. They never know when the next meal is going to be, but it's a reflex. It's an innate knowledge that they have. We have distorted our thinking and our natural tendencies oftentimes, and we have these three big meals a day, or two, or one, or we skip breakfast. We want to graze throughout the course of the day. It's easier on the digestive tract. Grazing, eating here and there every few hours, healthy snacks, again, those free of processing, those free of preservatives, those that are not overcooked or highly roasted, snacks that support us that are mostly live, like fruits and vegetables and raw nuts and seeds. These are just some choices. For those of you who have concerns about the sugar content of a dried fruit, for example, you want to listen to my show, Sugar, The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly, because I dispel some of the myths behind the different types of sugars. We just don't have time to go into that today. So grazing is very, very important. We want to chew our food extremely well. If we have known digestive problems or malabsorption, or we have a sense, or we've proven with testing and other types of questionnaires and things that our nutritional needs are greater than what we're getting, we probably would not want to be drinking fluids with our meals, at least not gulping down fluid. We could sip them, so that greater amounts of fluid dilute your stomach acid, which may be low or lower than what it should be, particularly if you're 50 years old and older. So I tend to sip here and there during my meals, but I'll save my fluids for a good 15 or 20 minutes after I eat, once the stomach starts to clear and the stomach acid starts to work on foods. If you stress out the stomach acid, the pancreas, which secretes protein, carbohydrate, and fat-digesting enzymes into the small intestine, which is the next place after the stomach where foods go. If those foods are not properly digested, if the stomach didn't do its job because you either didn't chew well enough, you didn't relax and eat and think about your food and really chew your foods until they're liquids, that tells your nervous system to secrete more enzymes to prepare your digestive tract, you're going to stress out your pancreas. Make sense? Okay, good. In terms of amounts to eat, I tend to base this on a lot of factors. Of course, one's age. Are they consuming medications? Are they particularly active? What are their daily activities? What is their exercise? What are their nutritional needs based on food logs and questionnaires and laboratory testing? Then there's a trial and error period to see if these foods change your chemistry and your sense of well-being, and then you figure out how much to eat. If your current way of eating or dieting is making you feel good, you want to make sure that your feeling good matches your chemistry and your body composition, and you have an adequate pH in your overall, I'm talking about pH in your overall body, not just pH in your stomach. But there are some challenge tests that I do and some laboratory tests to help determine if someone has normal digestive capacity either in the stomach and or the small intestine. And again, in terms of amounts, we figure all this out based on some evaluations. So let's talk about some of these diets that are out there. So we talk about the American diet, and we call it the SAD diet. You know, I just want to flip to a very important concept for just a second, and it's this question I keep getting, you know, why do diets fail? Diets fail because if diets are too difficult, you just have no chance of following through long enough for them to make changes in the body. So people get short-term results and then they sort of drift back to other findings, or they realize after a while that certain diets produce a certain result up to a point and they may not continue working for any number of reasons. Now, what I want to do with the rest of the time, and we have a decent amount of time left, I want to review about a dozen or so different dietary approaches. I'm going to start with, I started saying the standard American diet, or what we call the SAD diet. So we know over the last 150 years or so, and since the advent of the Industrial Revolution, that our diets are far higher in refined and processed carbohydrates. They are higher in processed meats that are loaded with antibiotics and hormones and all kinds of drugs and toxins. Our diets are far lower in fiber. They're much, much lower in unrefined, natural forms of carbohydrate. Our fat intake is much higher in trans fats and the saturated fats. So these trends have been inversely related to a rise in practically all-cause disease and quality of life depletion. So meaning the higher intake of all of that crap tends to be increase in diseases that we see, whether it's diabetes and cancers, heart disease, strokes, autoimmune disease, you name it. So the SAD diet is SAD for a reason. It's just not keeping up with our needs. Then people ask me, Dr. Wald, what about a vegetarian or vegan diet? Well, these diets are certainly, they fit a lot of the criteria. They're low on the food chain. We know, studies are clear, that the higher one's daily intake of fruits and vegetables, that the lower the rate of a variety of diseases and higher quality of life we tend to see as well. But I often see people doing these diets incorrectly. They end up with protein deficiencies. They may have malabsorption. Oh, sorry, not malabsorption, but low levels or non-optimal levels of B12 and sometimes folic acid, iron, vitamin C anemias. There are dozens of types of anemias. And anemia is a fancy term for deficiency. So all of these food plans I'm recommending can have potential problems if someone doesn't check in on them objectively once in a while to make sure they're fulfilling on their promise. So of course, a vegetable diet or a vegan diet or vegetarian diet may be ideal. But ideal for what? If someone needs a diet, let's say, that needs to be high in protein, the vegetable or vegetarian or vegan diet may not manage their needs. It also might. And some of you are thinking, yes, but there are plenty of high protein vegetables. And of course there are. But are they high enough to meet your disease needs? Maybe, maybe not. I'm simply saying, next, there's this food combining diet. And for those of you unfamiliar with that, food combining is based on this concept, is that a person may benefit from separating out or combining foods in specific ways to ease digestive burden. And food combining principles basically say that, as a general rule, it's best not to combine certain carbohydrates with certain proteins, and that certain proteins are very, very good to combine with what are known as non-starchy vegetables. And if you take those non-starchy vegetables and you eat them along with specific fats and oils, that you take digestive stress off the system. The stress of the pancreas secreting its protein, fat, and carbohydrate digesting enzymes. So is this the best diet? Well, if we define the best diet as a way of eating or a lifestyle that is easiest on the body, that promotes the best level of health possible, I would say there is a role for food combining more or less in different individuals. For those people who have symptoms and signs of low stomach acid and or pancreatic enzymes, if they eat foods that they have paid some attention to this food combining principle, then the theory goes that if the body's digesting, let's say, a protein like proteins in avocados with the fat of coconut oil, that would cause digestive distress. Well, nature combines protein starch and fatty foods in a particular food. You know, an avocado, for example, is very high in protein. It's also high, obviously, in olive oil. So why would those be on the poor food combining combination? Once again, if someone has digestive distress, then the principles of food combining might be part of their best diet. But if they also have a gluten intolerance or also have a certain level of malabsorption, or they want to gain weight or lose weight, or there's cancer or migraines or eczema, I think you get the picture. This might be part of the principle. So let's move on to another type of diet. Now, all of us have heard talk over the years of the benefits of the Mediterranean diet. Others have gone as far to say that it's the best diet on the planet. And the basic concepts behind, or the principal aspects of this diet, include that it's very high, proportionally speaking, in olive oil, which is cold pressed, fresh, non-oxidized olive oil, high in nutrition, legumes, unrefined cereals and fruits and vegetables. It'll typically contain a moderate to high consumption of fish, moderate or so consumption of dairy products, mostly in the form of cheeses and yogurts, moderate wine consumption, and a low consumption of the non-fish meat products. So, of course, we know that diets higher in olive oil tend to be associated with lower cardiovascular risk, some forms of cancer. Diets higher in legumes, for example, and much lower in unrefined cereals and high in fruits and vegetables. And all the aspects here of the Mediterranean diet may very well be what the doctor ordered in terms of what an individual person needs. But the strange thing is I've had many patients over the course of the last few decades that have adhered to the Mediterranean diet perfectly. I have looked at their food logs, etc., over years of time, and they still have specific health problems. They may have helped lower their blood fats, for example, which may or may not have decreased their cardiovascular risk, but they still tend to have complaints. So when I've made a slight change, for example, or major changes in their diet based on tests like malabsorption, finding out that, hey, if they don't have enough fat-digesting enzymes to properly digest olive oil or avocados, or they don't have enough stomach acid to digest the meat or the dairy products, I think you get the idea that the ideal diet must match the person. One should not put themselves in a diet. I suggest they formulate and fix a diet around them. As I said earlier in the show, and other high-level nutritionists like Gary Noh, for example, I believe tend to agree with this, is that it's a healthy lifestyle and basic lifestyle choices. Yes, that's true. And we need to then take those basic needs. Again, we all know them. Diets higher in fruits and vegetables, lower down on the food chain, less meat products, more omega-3 fatty acid containing foods, less fried food, no white flours and refined carbohydrates and simple sugars. These fundamental concepts are well proven out. They make sense. I've certainly seen over the last 25 plus years of doing what I'm doing that when people even make those simple changes, their health improves in a number of ways. But almost all of you know, based on your individual dietary and lifestyle food choice changes over the course of time, that it doesn't solve necessarily everything. It's important to be your own blood detective and find out what parts of all of these diets might work for your particular health goals, whether it's simply to maintain the level of health you have, or to improve it, or to manage specific symptoms or diseases, deal with certain medications, properly use nutritional supplements, and so on. Now, what about an acid-base diet, or an alkaline diet, as it's well known? This diet's also been called alkaline ash diet, alkaline acid diet. And the basic concept is that eating particular foods can favorably shift the body's pH or acid-base balance to help prevent disease and even treat disease. So this type of diet tends to focus on the hypothesis that if you avoid meat and cheese and poultry and grains, for example, you could make your urine more alkaline or increase its pH. And that's supposed to imply that that's changed the, of course, the urine environment, but also the blood environment. And foods do, in fact, change the urine pH and the saliva pH, but they don't so easily change the blood pH. Think of it this way. And I also want to encourage you to listen to my pH Lies show. I have a 15-minute version of the show and also an hour version. So I won't spend a ton of time right now describing this, but you'll want to listen to that course if you really want to understand acid, base, and diet. In a nutshell, I'll say the following. Although that there seems to be what the dietitian fields and also medicine in general feels there's no credible evidence to support the benefits of this alkaline diet, I and many of you out there know that if you eat foods supposedly on the alkaline list, such as fruits and vegetables, except for cranberries, prunes, and plums are not included, then you'd promote a more alkaline environment. And on the other hand, as I said, milk, poultry, cheese, fish, eggs, grains, they will promote an acid ash. But we are not what we eat. If a person requires, let's say, proteins to build protein-digesting enzymes in the pancreas, and eats protein, which is an acid ash food, but they eat that acid ash food, which is supposed to produce acid in the body, but the body breaks down that protein and gets it to the pancreas to make more cells that make pancreatic enzymes. And if those pancreatic enzymes include sodium bicarbonate, which is one of the things that the pancreas produces, that's alkaline. So what I just told you in a convoluted way is that you might eat something on the acid ash food list that actually helps produce an alkaline element in the body. Now, I certainly do believe, because I've seen this over and over, that the typical SAD, sad American diet, a diet with high, meats, sugars, and refined and processed foods are certainly unhealthy for lots and lots of reasons. They may be unhealthy because in that individual, they do drop or bring the pH of the body closer to acid. That might be true. I don't find that's reliably true because I measure the blood pH all the time. Now, the blood pH is very, very stable. The average blood pH should be between 7.35 and 7.45. Now, for those of you familiar with measuring your urine pH or your saliva pH, you're thinking of other numbers. The pH of the saliva and urine are much more widely varying. It is not at all the same as the blood pH. In fact, one could produce an alkaline pH in the urine and the saliva based on dietary changes simply because the good foods we're eating that happen to be on the alkaline list also happen to be healthy for lots of reasons, and they might help the body release certain elements that make the urine alkaline, but it doesn't mean that the blood is alkaline. It's very easy, in summary, in my opinion, to adversely affect, to lower the pH of the blood slightly, even to 7.2. And remember, I said the average range was 7.35 to 7.45. Let's just call that 7.4. Even 7.2, that's 20 times abnormal because pH is a logarithmic scale. I disagree with the medical profession and I disagree with the dietary profession. There is evidence, in fact, that this typical American diet, even supplements, can lower the pH adversely. And that might add to tumorigenesis or spreading of cancers. And on the other hand, a very good study in the Journal of Epidemiology some years ago showed that things like baking soda, sodium bicarbonate, very quickly shift the blood pH. Diet does not reliably shift it. So I don't recommend it as a single way for someone who wants and needs to shift their pH of their blood and or their urine or saliva. Again, wish we could talk more about it. Listen to the other show. Now, I'd like to talk right now about the ketogenic diet. Now, in the time we have left, I'll need to shorten my descriptions, but the ketogenic diet is a diet that does effectively increase the level of ketones in the body. And ketones are byproducts of things like meats and fats and also supplements like medium chain triglycerides, also known as MCTs. You'll find MCT oil in coconut oil. Coconuts and coconut oil contain about 25 to 30% MCTs. You know, I was speaking with a patient yesterday. He has stage 4 pancreatic cancer. He's wasting away. He has food intolerances due to enzyme depletion and other stressors. And one of the things that he might need, you might think, is that, oh, maybe we need to make his pH more alkaline, increase it. But his pH was fine. So the pH balancing acid, alkaline ash diet did not seem to apply, other than the fact that you better believe I put him on a so-called healthy diet based on the things we've discussed as the fundamentals in the show. But he needs a ketogenic effect as well because the MCT oil helps to offset muscle and organ wasting in the body during cancer and practically all degenerative diseases of any type. The body wastes away. It's catabolic. That means it breaks down. We lose our lean body mass, which is our organs and our muscle mass. The loss of that lean organ mass tends to be related to increased death rate and loss of quality of life. So here's a person who needs aspects of a ketogenic diet. Because he has food intolerances, I would add principles of food combining. I would also give him enzymatic supplements and possibly even stomach acid. Uh-oh, that sounds evil. Stomach acid? Well, if you increase someone's stomach acid and they digest their alkaline ash foods better, you might help promote alkalinity. So it gets a bit complicated. The blood detective concept is not about one size fits all. It's about simply figuring out what your needs are. And then with this particular gentleman with the stage 4 cancer, his laboratory work shows all kinds of specific nutritional issues that I need to manage. So he ends up with his best diet. But even traditional dietitians that manage hospital-based food, we don't want to get into that too much, hospital-based food. My point in bringing that up is that for certain diseases like pancreatitis and certain cancers or heart disease, even the dietitians make some allowances for certain foods not, you know, to be eliminated from the diets in the hospitals and some not to be. Although I must say, as a trained dietitian, in my experience, hospitals fall very, very short of consistency in that area and doing a good enough job on a number of levels. So let's move to a different type of diet concept. Let's call it the food allergy elimination diet. If you eat perfectly well, regardless of what that might mean for you, let's just assume we know what that means. What is your optimal perfect diet? On paper, it's rich in, again, vegetables, and you're not eating any refined processed foods, and you might even be paying some attention to Mediterranean principles, and you're gravitating much more towards the alkaline type foods. And this is what a vegetarian or vegan type of a diet does, not saying that that's appropriate for everyone or a macrobiotic diet. What the point here now is that if you're allergic to broccoli, an alkaline ash food, if you're allergic to any of the other foods, the allergy stress on the body defeats the purpose of the potential benefit of the food. So if one's allergic to, broccoli, or they're allergic to apples or any other fruit, that causes an immune reaction, which tends to be pro-inflammatory, and that tends to be acid ash producing, and all sorts of inflammatory mediators are produced from the immune system that either produce allergic wheals on the skin, the typical, what they call type 1 food allergens, or the person might develop delayed or IgG-type food allergies where they might not experience symptoms until several days later, even weeks later, and the symptoms are not at all allergic wheals on the skin. They could be everything from headaches to depression to mood changes to fertility issues, all kinds of things. So once again, of considering food allergy concepts is important. Now, as a blood detective, I must say that if I see a person who has obvious signs of inflammation based on the health conditions they have or symptoms, then I might not do tests of food allergies first, because inflammation can cause false food allergy testing. Sticking foods, little particles of foods that allergists love to do on the skin, for example, to tell you if you're allergic to something or not, I think is very inaccurate, very misleading, and it's not very reproducible. Your body needs to eat a food. Plus, those food samples that allergists use to stick under the skin are from laboratories and they're processed. You might be allergic to those and not allergic to the food you actually eat. So there are problems with food allergy tests. I've seen time and time again, people are getting pages of expensive food allergy tests, and then they eliminate all these different types of foods. Now, if you stop eating a bunch of foods, almost anyone might have fewer symptoms, but it's not because you eliminated the right foods. It's because you're not eating. It's no different, or you're eating less than someone with a gallbladder problem that gets admitted to a hospital. The first thing they do is give them no food PO, no food per oral, and then their gallbladder calms down until they eat again. Once I measure a variety of inflammatory markers with a person that I suspect has food allergies and I get those inflammatory markers down, then I do appropriate either IgE and or IgG food allergy tests. But the best test of allergy is to look at a comprehensive food list of the more common foods a person eats. Take the top 5, for example, eliminate them for at least 2 solid weeks. A person might feel better if you eliminate the allergy foods, and when you add them back, their symptoms may return. However, that symptom return and going away phenomenon could be for many other reasons, such as the person doesn't have enough stomach acid or enzymes to digest certain foods. So when you eliminate them, there's less stress on the system. So I always check for enzymes by doing enzymes and sometimes stomach acid functional testing. I might also do blood testing and other testing. I may certainly do inflammatory tests. I certainly may do allergy tests at certain points. When I look at a person's body composition, their muscle, water, fat percentage, and metabolic rate, that's how you know how much calories someone needs to maintain their current weight. But if they have cancer, they need to gain lean body mass. If they're over fat, they need to lose fat mass. If they have certain health conditions that require a certain dose of medium chain triglycerides or a ketogenic diet, you know, that ketogenic diet can be very good for weight loss. The ketogenic diet in the traditional sense, which if you read the ketogenic diet book, with high fats and high animal products, for example, the original one, that's not conducive to health. I put people on the best diet I can determine for them, and then I augment it with ketogenic producing supplements because they're super easy to add into the diet and they reliably cause ketosis. How do I know? I measure the blood level of ketones and the urine level of ketones. The urine level alone may not be enough. And medical studies back up what I'm saying, that most people fail on ketogenic diets, but a best healthy diet for them that we would determine plus MCT oils and maybe high levels of raspberry type of things, these reliably promote ketogenesis. So it's good for weight loss. It's good for seizures. Anything neurological, dementia, multiple sclerosis, neuropathies, ketogenic diet is absolutely ideal. So to come back to a different kind of reality here for a second, what I'm really talking about here is a best diet for the person. So whatever disorder or health goal or disease a person has, I like to say all the time to my patients the truth. The person needs what they need for their needs. They have a diagnosis, which is just a descriptive term. What their chemistries might show, if I have 10 women or 10 men in front of me with either breast or prostate cancer or heart disease or psoriasis, whatever it is, the same conditions, their laboratory work, their genetics, their tolerance to nutrients, their food allergies, their digestive capacities, their abilities to respond digestively to food combinations or not are very, very different. Maybe they have allergies to some of the key foods in the Mediterranean diet. So when we hear about studies that talk about how, like I just wrote an article, I commented on how ADHD seemed to statistically improve upon a Mediterranean diet, and my basic thoughts on that is, of course, that makes some sense. The diet's high in omega-3 fatty acids. It's low in the acid ash foods. It's low in the refined processed carbohydrates. It has tons of fruits and vegetables. Again, there's nothing miraculous about the Mediterranean diet. It just has several components that make sense for many people, but never all. So I've kept mentioning a number of times how there are certain fundamental ways of eating which I consider a baseline. And I call that my healthy diet basic suggestions. They're all on my blog, by the way. If you just search my blog, you'll see them. And again, we've been talking about them, the basic things about sugar, refined fats, carbohydrates, all that kind of stuff, saturated fats, eating lower down the food chain. But it is true, in my opinion, that certain alkaline concepts and then certain foods that promote detoxification in the body because they contain higher amounts of the nutrition we need to actually push the known detox pathways in the body. And also there are other foods that seem to be more hormonally friendly. There are yet other foods that seem to be more specific about the liver's detox as opposed to the gallbladder or the lymphatic system or the pulmonary system or the cardiovascular system. So I have developed 10 and 20 day breakfast, lunch, dinner, snack, and recipe plans for alkaline dieting and detox, as I've said, and liver cleansing and hormone balancing and vegan and cancer food guidelines and low protein and higher protein, vegan, not vegan. I start those as a base, like my healthy diet basic, basic stuff. Then I build individuality from that. For those of you interested in those sorts of food plans, I have a food plan and recipe book on the website at www.integratednutrition.com. of NewYork.com, or just go to blooddetective.com. On blooddetective.com, there's a book section right at the top, and you'll see most of my publications are there. And then, what is the best diet for an athlete? Well, what kind of athlete are we talking about? Does that athlete have a health problem? Is that athlete on medication? Is that athlete taking certain nutrients? What sort of exercises are they doing? When are they doing it? What's the extent of the exercise? How hard are they working? What are their long and short-term athletic and health goals? The list goes on, but these are all very manageable things. I also happen to be a double sports certified nutritionist, and I can tell you that the nutrition in that area is very, very precise, and of course it applies to health in general. Many of the concepts of enhancing sports nutrition are very good for building a person's health up from chronic disease and even cancers. So my point is that you need to know what a person wants to do and what their lifestyle is about, and then borrowing from different aspects of these diets, because they're not different. They're just concepts, and we need to just invent what a person requires. And then, to throw a little bit of a wrench in there, you know, our needs change along the life cycle of human beings, from newborn to death, and along that scale, we have varying needs. I have certainly found, and my patients, I've found this as well in them, is that a person may have a different nutritional needs based on their changing health, and you have to change with that. So again, you start with basics, you change ratios of things. Oftentimes, a person will become sensitive enough to know how to make certain changes. Many times, patients of mine who thought they were reading their body signs right and were sensitive enough were absolutely wrong. So that's why I like to combine a combination of what I call holistic common sense, developing a sense of your body. You know, for example, you certainly know when you need to eat, or most of us at least do, because we get hunger pangs for that. So that's just a simple example of, we have a sense. Others will say to me, oh, I know my blood sugar was low, or I know that I need more protein in my diet, or I know that gluten is not good for me, I'm affected by GMOs. We have a sense of things, but not always do the labs match the sense, or do the sense match the labs. And if we're relying on our sense of things, but our chemistry is off, well, couldn't our senses be off too? So why choose one or the other when we can use our holistic common sense, have a health coach, look at biochemistry? I say, use it all. Now, no conversation about the best diet would be complete unless I speak about gluten. So I did write a book, most of which is actually on my blog, called Glutenaholic. I also have videos all about gluten and interviews with me regarding that topic. So I have a conversation and research on gluten you probably have never heard before. For example, if you do have a gluten intolerance, digestive enzymes, I use my detox absorb enzymes will break down gluten to make it far less sensitizing to the body. Now, for a person with celiac disease that must eliminate gluten for an entire lifetime, they still might have gluten slip in from time to time. So I advise those patients to have digestive enzymes. Also, I use my Superbug probiotic, because probiotics also break down and denature gluten differently than enzymes do. So the combination, of course, is good for anyone. Enzymes and probiotics, those are sort of basic nutritional supplements that practically anyone should have, especially if they're over about 40. But my point here with mentioning the gluten diet is, if you have a gluten issue, you name it. As I say in my book, gluten can be the masquerader of any disease or symptom. So now, gluten, and some of you may argue this, might be fine for someone else. Now, my basic opinion on gluten is that it has been introduced into the human food chain far too soon. It is not the same. The gluten grains now are processed and probably even genetically manipulated in such a way that even if we tolerated gluten at some point in our early development as human beings, it's just not the same food now. But my point here is that for some people, the best diet is a gluten-free diet, but maybe they need a gluten-free diet that also is one that manages regular blood sugar, or also includes certain aspects of a Mediterranean-style diet. The only confusing thing about this conversation is that I might be giving the impression to some that we have to pick and choose things from different separate kind of diets. That's not what I'm saying. that there are fundamental needs that people have, then there are specific needs that people have at certain points in time. And then they have changing needs over a period of time, and some periodic retesting, reconversation, looking at food logs, all these different types of things working together really can help a person find out their best diet, or what I like to call food lifestyle choices. Now, what about a malabsorptive diet? That implies that there is a diet that a person could eat that would help their malabsorption. Again, malabsorption is a term meaning you do not absorb normally. What are the symptoms of malabsorption? Anything. If you don't absorb fatty acids well, you could develop dementia. You might have eczema. You might just have dry skin. You might be constipated. You might have depression. You might have a neurologic disease. The list goes on and on. The symptoms and the health problems associated with different types of malabsorptive syndromes, which you can listen to in my malabsorption show, my everything digestion show, are varied depending on the nutritional elements or compounds that are malabsorbed. So there is no one size fits all malabsorption diet. I had a person just a few days ago who I diagnosed with pernicious anemia. That is a malabsorption disease. So of B12. She also has a history of alcoholism. So those two factors mean that the alcohol probably thinned out her stomach lining. The stomach lining cells make stomach acid. She could not produce enough stomach acid to cleave or break B12 from protein in food. She developed a B12 deficiency, which is a pernicious anemic trait. And then she happened to develop a neuropathy, which were chronic nerve pain and sensations and tingling and numbness in her fingertips and even in her toes. So depending on the malabsorption needs and then looking at the specific nutritional deficiencies she had, I was able to give her a food plan that was higher in those nutrients specifically that had a bend toward the alkaline side, that was a ketogenic bend as well because there's nervous system involved. Are you starting to see how amazingly well we can actually figure out an individual's needs if we just pay attention to the individual? So many times I see in my profession people being placed in rigid diet plans as opposed to developing the plan, the lifestyle plan that's doable around them. A few minutes ago, I was rattling off a variety of basic diets that I use. Again, I call them alkaline diet and detox diet and a healthy basics diet and a vegan and a liver cleanse diet and a hormone balancing diet and an anti-inflammation diet. Let's just take the anti-inflammation diet basic suggestions here for a second. So I'm not going to go into the foods that would be anti-inflammation because you can guess many of them. Again, lower in the cheeses and the fats and a higher, of course, in plant products as basics, very basic things. But if a person has an inability to digest some of those foods, if they have an allergy to those foods, then those foods are not anti-inflammation for them, even though in every natural healthcare textbook and radio show you'll ever hear, they'll say they're anti-inflammation. Does that make sense? And then some people look at me when they see me and they say, well, why didn't this work? I did it exactly like this. It seemed to work for a while and then it didn't. Well, the reason is because it wasn't what you thought on the surface. So when I measure as a blood detective, I measure various inflammatory mediators. I need to see these inflammatory mediators reduce. Oftentimes people will feel better when they simply just change a diet for a lot of reasons. The mind is a powerful thing. It directs the body, but they don't actually fix the inflammation. So we need to do both. So my approach is when someone sits with me is I have them fill out a detailed paperwork about their health history, their goals, their medications, the nutrients, their genetic history, their family health history, their personal health history, and a lot of other factors. I look over any prior laboratory tests. We very carefully define goals through a lengthy conversation. Based on that conversation, I suggest specific tests. Some of them are blood. Some of them are urine. Some of them are saliva. Some of them are functional tests, like a body composition test. I might do any number of tests that help me figure out objectively what a person needs, so I have exact guidelines. I have to always measure a variety of potential forms of malabsorption. Again, how can we develop the ideal diet plan for someone or lifestyle plan if they malabsorb? It's the first step. I am astounded when I don't see two things when people have attempted to manage their health over long periods of time. One, there have not been assessments of absorption capability. And two, there's not been a body composition that tells us how the rate, someone's metabolic rate, how they burn calories. So I know at least I'm in the ballpark of what sort of protein, carbohydrate, and fat they need in their diets. And also their intra and extracellular water content, which gives us many clues about health and health potential and what to do. So that'll be the end of today's show. And I would like you please to send me your show topic ideas to info@blooddetective.com. My website is www.integratednutritionny.com or blooddetective.com. Our next show on Ask the Blood Detective, I've entitled Health Confidence. That show, during that show, I'm going to discuss with you specific evaluations, things that you can do at home, things that you do with your healthcare provider in terms of tests that let you know if your efforts are actually working beyond just you feeling better. We want feeling better and we want the correlation with the testing. Thank you so very much for joining me today. My name is Dr. Michael Wald. I'm the director of Integrated Nutrition of Mount Kisco. It's about an hour north of New York City. My number at the office is 914-242-8844. The email again is info@blooddetective.com. And the website is www.integratednutritionny.com. And I'll see you next time. Come out, Virginia. Don't let me wait. Catholic girls start much too late. Show you a statue, told you to pray. They built two temples and locked you away. Ah, but they never told you the price that you pay, the things that you might have done.